members. Welcome, good morning, and welcome everybody to this portfolio committee meeting. We have got only two items today. We're going to receive a presentation from the department on the update on the implementation of the Paris Agreement. And we're also going to get a presentation from SUN on the fourth quarter report 2015-16 and the first quarter for 2016-17. I'd like to welcome a colleague. We are told that we've got a new member from the EFF, Solile Roger Palisa. You're welcome, honorable member. We're happy that the EFF is joining us. We've not been having a presence of the EFF for some time, so, and that has been affecting our quorum. So we're happy that you are here, honorable member. Welcome, DG, to the meeting. Welcome, everybody. The deputy chair of Tadimachi of Sandy, you're welcome. It's good that you are here because we did make a request in the last meeting that when the entities appear, we also prefer that the chair of the board is at least at the minimum. The chair of the board also attend in the absence of the chair. He or she can delegate somebody. So we're happy that you are here. The CEO of Sambi. We were very cross with you the other day, the last meeting, when you did not reach up and we didn't receive an apology. But subsequent to that, maybe I must just inform the members that my office did receive a formal apology from the CEO that she had to attend to some meeting where she's given a responsibility to South African Tourism. Is it South African Tourism? Yeah, she's a chair. Yeah, she's a chair there in that entity. So apparently the office failed to communicate with Parliament. But it's important, I must reiterate that this type of things, you must make sure that you take care of them. Call the chair if you are not going to be able to make it, or write the letter of apology so that we are informed beforehand. We don't want to be surprised when we come to the meeting and people who are supposed to come and account to us are not present. So we took a very serious view of that, but we accept the apology. As I was saying earlier, that you see, I don't want us to start on a bad note because there were also some, I don't want to say misunderstanding. There was some miscommunication. Initially, we were scheduled to get a briefing from Sambi today, and the secretary got information that there is an activity that was planned for today, so we moved it to Thursday. And then, just this week, actually over the weekend, we got information that no, we must move it from Thursday back to Wednesday. Because the indication was that the minister wanted to attend. And now is today. Maybe I was supposed to have given the apology of the minister. I spoke to her yesterday. She's got a trip to India. She's leaving today, so she said she's not going to be able to come. I was surprised because she told me last week that she will be taking a trip today. So, but I hope that this is not going to characterize our future interaction with the board. I'm that nation in me, because when we start like this, the tendency is that, you know, we are always going to receive whatever that comes from Sunday with some level of skepticism because of how we're studying. But nevertheless, you're welcome. Welcome, honorable members. With peace and apology. Honorable Mabilo is attending another committee, social development. And the honorable Kikana is on oversight with the water and sanitation. Also saying in that committee. The DG has indicated she would like to be released around 11:30 to attend to another meeting. So yeah, I don't know whether there's any apology from the members. None. DG?
Also traveling abroad to the minister. The minister was going to do the Ocean Economy International meeting. However, the presidency asked her to join in on the bridge meeting in her other role as the chair of the ICT. That's why I'm very supportive in that capacity. And definitely, Chair, I would plead to honorable members that the entity has no direct engagement on the program. The miscommunication would have been between the ministry and the secretariat. So I would honestly plead that the entity must not deal with the activity. Because of that, and we appreciate that you accepted the apology from the CEO for the previous meeting where she could not be here. Thank you so much.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Alright, thanks for the clarification. So I guess we can start with the presentation. DJ?
Thank you, Chair. The DDG response for climate change and air quality will lead us on the briefing regarding implementation of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change Paris Agreement, which has to be ratified by this Parliament. Over to you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Member DG. So what I will do as the portfolio committee has requested is just give you a bit of background around the outcome of COP21, South Africa's approach to COP22, and the status of implementation. So the 25th Conference of the Parties of the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change was quite a celebratory moment. It was the culmination of a four-year negotiation process that started in Durban at COP17 in 2011. And the outcome in Paris, the Paris Agreement, was really universally recognized as a real victory in multilateral negotiation process. And a very solid global outcome to fight the global challenge of climate change. There was also a set of decisions that were included, which really guides the process of preparation for entry into force of the Paris Agreement, which is essentially from 2020. You will have seen in the media, however, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members, that USA and China at G20 signaled their ratification, and I will give you the figures a little bit later, what this means in terms of progress towards the double trigger of entry into force, and there's the possibility that it will happen earlier, and what this means. Thank you. So the key features of the Paris Agreement, it really gives us a very strong legally binding international framework to guide global efforts around responding to climate change. It clearly embeds the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities between developed and developing countries, and I think it puts us into an era in which there now is a very, very close linkage, which we have not had before, between the international, multilateral negotiation process and domestic or national implementation processes. And what this means is that the principle of common and differentiated responsibility is now in a place of no longer simply being a global principle, but now we're having to grapple with the challenges of what this means in terms of implementation and operationalization. The key goal of the Paris Agreement is the goal of limiting global temperature increase or keeping it well below 2 degrees Celsius and really enhancing efforts and urging efforts to limit the increase to 1.5 degrees. There is a global adaptation goal, which honorable members will recall that was a real battle that was led by the Africa Group in terms of obtaining multilateral support for a global goal on adaptation. Then we have the nationally determined contributions which need to be made by all countries every 5 years to contribute to the global goals for mitigation and adaptation. And the point that all nationally determined contributions must represent a progression from where countries have made their first INDC. South Africa has submitted, well, before Paris, South Africa submitted its intended nationally determined contribution, our goal for implementation and adaptation. And then countries have an obligation to report on implementation of the NDC. Just a few of the details of the Paris Agreement, just to fill a little bit of context. So new nationally determined contributions are submitted every 5 years. So our nationally determined, at this stage, intend the nationally determined contribution until such time as we ratify the Paris Agreement, sets out our commitment from 2020 to 2025, which means that the next set of commitments will be from 2025 to 2030 to 2035, etc. So we have built our national implementation cycle around these five-year cycles so that we are in alignment and in sync with the international processes. So South Africa's mitigation system now is setting our own processes for the five-year cycle. We've got a pilot system now from 2016 to 2020. We then have a mandatory system from 2021 to 2025. Followed by the following five-year cycles. A global stocktake will occur every 5 years to assess progress in implementation, and that is collective progress in implementation. In other words, there will be a process of aggregating on a five-year basis all of the achievements by countries across the world, both from an adaptation perspective and a mitigation perspective, and adding these up against the global goals to see the extent to which the world is or is not on track, as the case may be. And countries will be required to take the outcome of this global stocktake into account when they reconsider their next set of commitments. Adaptation is central to the Paris Agreement, as we've said, this was very much part of South Africa and Africa's objective and intention in the Paris Agreement. And here the issue was to get balance between mitigation and adaptation. And the key underlying principle here is that the less emission reduction there is globally, the greater the burden of adaptation, in particular in developing countries. And Africa, which is really predicted to be particularly hard hit, particularly by increasing temperatures and reduced rainfall, need that global recognition and support, funding in particular support for adaptation processes and programming. Also included is that developed countries will continue to provide and mobilize finance to support developing countries in the post-2020 period. There was agreement that there would be a new market with similarities to the CDM mechanism. Loss and damage from impact of climate change is clearly built into the agreement and is separate from adaptation, and that refers to the support to countries where they have experienced severe loss and damage, for example, from drought, from floods, etc. Also provisions for technology transfer, capacity building and response measures. Thank you. The decisions covering the pre-2020 period relate to the set of rules that need to be developed under the ad hoc working group on the Paris Agreement, and that is the rules that would enable the effective entry into force and implementation of the Paris Agreement. And that's the work that we are already doing, and COP22 in Morocco is the first and most important opportunity to get those rules on the table. Also, COP11 concluded the rule set for the second commitment period to the protocol. COP11 also included a review of the modalities and the procedures for the clean development mechanism. There's a technical examination process on adaptation, and the importance of this is that there's a multilateral process of countries sharing best practice and technical approaches and programs that are up and running, that are working in respect of adaptation. It's a similar process on emission reduction. And again, this was part of the process of getting the balance between mitigation and adaptation in the agreement. There were financial pledges to the adaptation fund of $35 million and financial pledges to the least developed country fund of $148 million. Thank you. So now we are faced with the next step, which is ratification of the Paris Agreement. And to consolidate the success of Paris, all countries were urged to ratify the agreement as soon as possible. And of course, it's important that we take a leadership role by ratifying the agreement early. To some extent, I think the ratification by China and the US has pushed this forward and has added a new political dynamic, which was not very much anticipated. And the anticipation was that it would probably take at least 2 years from COP21, which was in December 2015, at least 2 years, and probably 3 years, to get to the point that we are at today. But obviously what has happened in the view of the US electoral process, and what seems to be coming up in that context, and the bilateral agreement with China, there is now a new level of, I think, excitement, but also a new set of challenges in respect of what this could mean domestically for countries that have parliamentary processes that take likely longer to complete the ratification process. On the 22nd of April this year, South Africa became a signatory to the Paris Agreement, the agreement was open for signature at the UN headquarters from the 22nd of April this year and will continue to be open until the 21st of April 2017. Once you have signed, once a country has signed, it's simply a signal that ratification is imminent and the processes are underway. And certainly, it was quite a precedent in the UN processes of 185 countries signing, which signaled almost universal ratification over a period of time. The Paris Agreement entered in force on the 50th day after the date on which at least 55 parties to the convention, accounting in total for at least 55% of the global greenhouse gas emissions, have deposited their instruments of ratification
or acceptance or approval or accession. It depends on domestic processes whether countries follow any one of those different options. And the UN Secretary General has arranged a high-level event in New York on the 21st of September as part of the UN General Assembly to encourage parties to deposit the instruments of ratification. Obviously, this would mean that those countries would already have concluded the ratification process domestically, and they're simply ready to deposit. Thank you. Next slide. So I've already mentioned the question of the USA and China. So at the moment, we have 29 countries, including the US and China. Cameroon and Somalia from Africa are part of the 29 countries which have ratified, and that accounts for 39% of the total emissions. So there's a lot of numbers going on. The USA has done their various pathways towards ratification, counting up the countries that are likely to ratify, and certainly the US is doing quite a lot of lobbying to get as many countries to deposit their instruments by COP22. The likelihood is that they are not going to get to that 55-55, the double trigger of 55 countries and 55%. The EU, for example, is not a, their processes, their ratification processes are extremely complicated because they have domestic processes per country, and then they have the EU process in addition to that. At the moment, there's only two EU countries that have ratified, and that is France and Hungary. The signals we have is that the EU will not be able to finalize ratification until next year. There are various predictions on countries that are likely to ratify. Argentina is likely to. Australia probably not, although they have signaled their intention to. Brazil has ratified. India probably not, at least not before COP22. Ghana from Africa is certainly doing what it can and is signaling that it would ratify in November. So there's a various list of what is possible. South Africa, in terms of our process is guided by Section 231 of the Constitution. We have done our national stakeholder consultation process through a series of provincial consultations. We are finalizing the third economic impact assessment, which is required by presidency. Presidency would then approve the third economic impact assessment. We then get approval from the cabinet, and then of course it gets tabled in parliament. Next slide. The Paris Agreement requires South Africa to, as I said, to submit our nationally determined contribution. The next one will be due in 2023. What we have done is develop a national mitigation system, which includes a mitigation potential analysis that analyzes what the potential is and where the potential, which sectors include the greatest potential at least cost for reducing our emissions. That then gives us a sense of what is possible, both technically, and also what is possible in terms of the policies and measures that are already programmed. So, for example, our renewable energy program, our energy efficiency programs, our green transport programs, climate smart agriculture programs that are starting to emerge, and the extent to which further rolling out and further scaling up of those programs will achieve emission reductions. We also have the responsibility to account for progress in terms of achieving our goals. And we have a national climate change response tracking system in place. The first annual climate change report has been published, and I will make that available to members. And the annual climate change response report looks at progress from an adaptation perspective and from an emission reduction perspective, and demonstrates the extent to which or the areas in which South Africa is or is not transitioning, making a transition to a lower carbon and climate resilient economy and society. We're also required to submit our biennial report to the UNFCCC on our national circumstances, our emissions, adaptation programs. The second biennial update report has been published for public comment. It was published, in fact, it was released for public comment on Monday this week. And it's on our website. The biennial update report is almost a listing of all of the projects and what emission reductions have been achieved from each of those projects, those emission reduction or adaptation projects with the state, and the extent to which there are co-benefits such as job creation or air pollution outcomes that are associated with those programs. Our greenhouse gas inventory has also been published for public comment. That is the 2012 greenhouse gas inventory, and that inventory is an aggregation of what South Africa's emissions are total and per sector. We are always approximately 4 years behind, because it's quite hard to get the data. So we currently are publishing for public comment our greenhouse gas inventory from 2000 to 2012. So we're already to 2016, but that's the 4 year gap. And what we're doing at the moment is a process of improvement and enhancing the extent to which we are able to process the data, receive the data, and process the data. We have, for example, greenhouse gas reporting regulations, which will shift our greenhouse gas reporting system from a voluntary system by business and industry to a mandatory system. And we are aiming for the next greenhouse gas inventory to push us down to 3 years gap, and then the following greenhouse gas inventory will push us down to a 2 year gap. So we're getting closer and closer to not like real-time reporting, but certainly closer to a more accurate analysis of our greenhouse gas inventory. The development of South Africa's National Climate Change Adaptation Strategy is well underway, as is the framework for reducing greenhouse gas emissions, which includes the carbon budgeting system, the greenhouse gas planning processes, and the greenhouse gas reporting system, and it includes other instruments such as the carbon tax. We have a climate change response monitoring evaluation system that is in place. It's a web-based program. Part of the reality is we will have to increase the pace of implementation. Really, these are about instruments of enabling emission reductions, or enabling implementation. The reality is that the reduced emissions come from programs such as our renewable energy program, our energy efficiency program, shifting to public transport, for example. We do need to scale up investment and scale up implementation, and all civil governments will need to refine their strategies for adapting to the impacts of climate change and enhancing the capacity of institutions, services, infrastructure, ecosystem services to respond to and bounce back from the impact of climate change. Essentially, the targets that we are seeking to achieve set out in our IMDC from an adaptation perspective is that we have a national adaptation plan. We have climate change integrated into local planning processes. We are building institutional capacity, and we have an early warning monitoring system. For COP22 will be focused on beginning the process of developing the rules to guide the work of parties under the Paris Agreement. The ad hoc working group on the Paris Agreement will provide further guidance on in terms of, for example, features of nationally determined contributions in future. It will also begin consideration of modalities and procedures for the enhanced transparency framework, and what that simply means is the making sure that all countries are reporting on progress with their national commitments in a manner that enables enables it multilaterally to compare apples to apples. So at the moment, there are quite big disparities between the way countries present their information. And particularly in the context of adaptation, that's a new area of work. So there's quite a lot of work that needs to be done around how we ensure consistency of information against which countries are reporting, so that the global stock take is a meaningful global stock take. It's a real meaningful aggregation of progress. The COP22 should therefore provide a roadmap to ensure that all the work will be concluded in time to be adopted by the first meeting of the parties to the Paris Agreement, and also to make rapid progress with important issues to be addressed in the pre-2020 period, and particularly particularly relates to finance and support for developing countries. There will also be a high-level ministerial dialogue on climate financing at COP22, focusing on adaptation finance and adaptation needs and the support available to push countries into a space of readiness. Some of the key issues for South Africa for COP22 are the finance for adaptation in the pre-2020 period, finance for mitigation and technology transfer, ensuring that the technical examination process for mitigation and adaptation are functional, ensuring the successful launch of the Paris Committee on Capacity Building, and getting its work underway between 2016 and 2020. Next. A clear work program leading up to the entry into force of the Paris Agreement, and a clear pathway to realize 100 billion per annum by 2025. Is there another slide? Yes. Just to say that in terms of, the question now is, what happens if the double trigger of 55 countries and 55% is reached, and it's reached in COP22, or it could be reached just after COP22 by the end of the year. What does that mean for inclusiveness and ensuring that we don't have a situation in which only those countries that have ratified are sitting around the table and making the multilateral decisions? The most likely scenario is that the COPMOP, which is the Paris Agreement conference of the parties acting as the meeting of the parties for Paris Agreement, would be convened. As soon as we reach the double trigger, it would be convened, but it would then be suspended pending ratification of as many countries as possible. There's a possibility that there would be a time frame put to when the COPMOP. So there's a possibility. Okay. So the indication is that the countries that have ratified would be sitting around the table in the conference of the parties, acting as the meeting of the parties for the Paris Agreement. So the institutional arrangement that is convened once the agreement reaches entry in force, reaches that double trigger, would have as decision makers around the table those countries that have ratified, and would have as observers around the table those countries that have yet to ratify. So for South Africa, in the event that we had not ratified by the end of the year, we would be an observer in the first meeting of the parties of the Paris Agreement. That meeting of the parties is likely to then be suspended to give as many more countries an opportunity to shift from observer status to actual decision-making status through ratification. Our analysis of this, and ALP has been at a meeting very recently that may have given a little bit more detail and clarity on this, our analysis is that in all likelihood there would be a timing, a period of time, not an indefinite amount of time, but a period of time given to countries to get their ratification processes finalized. whether that period of time is 1 year or 6 months, I think that is part of, going to probably be part of the negotiation process at COP22. But it would put pressure on countries to get their ratification processes in order. The principle, however, that South Africa is pushing very strongly and I think has been accepted, received favorably, is the principle of inclusiveness. So that any decision-making under the Paris Agreement must be an inclusive decision-making process. So that means that whatever institutional arrangement you set up, we must give countries that require additional time for ratification to get their house in order and to be around the table, so that the Paris Agreement is functioning from a perspective of full inclusiveness and we don't have some parties that are putting us off service. I hope that helps you.
Yeah, that's true. Maybe I would also suggest that maybe Alf can add on in light of the recent meeting that he attended on behalf of South Africa. My sense also is that maybe the question that we should be asking ourselves is what is it going to take for South Africa to ratify before COP22? Ideally, I think my limited advice in the multilateral environment, if you have the US and China having ratified, that COP meeting can make decisions possibly. Even if we make our voice about inclusivity outside, it may not have the same catch compared to when we make that input in part of the country that would have ratified. So I think it at least also South Africa has the credibility to speak on behalf of G77 plus China, and therefore if it happened even in Paris, we led we were in a leadership role in respect of the continent. So we would be more a trusted broker for the continent if we have ratified. So I think this there is a bit of urgency in us having to follow through the process and enable that at least we play safe in December.
Earlier this year, 7th to 17th. That brought it for the ship, brought it forward.
Yes.
I think one of the implications that the reason that South Africa is under such pressure to ratify is that by 20th of January, if the Paris Agreement comes into force by 20 January, then the US is bound into the Paris Agreement. At the moment, they ratified the Paris Agreement by executive order, so they did not go through Congress and the Senate in particular, with 57 votes in the Senate to ratify, and the Republicans don't control 67 as Democrats. So what they've done is they've ratified, accepted the Paris Agreement by executive order. Should the Trump administration come in, the Trump administration has already pronounced that they would reverse that executive order on the first day of Trump's administration. But if the Paris Agreement is in force legally, they can't get out of it. So they would be, the U.S. would be bound. So fundamentally, that's the reason that we're under pressure. If you look at the numbers, as Judy said, at the moment it's 27 countries and 39% of world emissions. Theoretically, because of the 30 days, you could go 30 days from the 20th of January backwards. So by the 20th of December, thereabouts, you would need that 55%. So theoretically, it's possible that that the 55-55 trigger could be reached in December. It's not possible to do it before November when you look at the numbers. So it's very likely, it's highly unlikely that the first meeting of the parties to the Paris Agreement will take place this year in November, because the double trigger will not have been met. But it will be likely that the first meeting of parties would meet next year in November. And one of the reasons that South Africa is under such pressure is when you look at the number, theoretically, 54% is doable, not 55% is doable. And South Africa emits 1.4% of global emissions, and that's why we are under pressure as the so-called savior of the Paris Agreement. Because if the Trump administration gets in place, we are in fact the controlling vote, if you want, of keeping the Americans in the agreement. So that's the reason that we are under such pressure. Because when they add up Australia and all the others that are lagging, they will only reach 53.8 or something percent of world emissions. And so our 1.4% is like the super vote. So the other thing that came out is that many countries that have already ratified, including Brazil, are cognizant of the fact that the issue of the cycles, the five-year cycles, is not allocated to any other body other than the CMA, other than the meeting of parties. And that piece of work is absolutely critical to make the Paris Agreement work. And so there are parties that want to convene and make decisions next year at this first meeting. So this, although Judy is saying that there's a possibility of suspension, there will be pressure to begin work at least and then suspend. And fundamentally, the other issue is that in 2018, so the following year, is the what they call the international dialogue on the INDCs. So the 2020 to 2025 period numbers will be under review with a view to increasing ambition in 2018. And so it's unlikely that any extension past suspension past 2018 will happen. So the 2018 is like the outer deadline, if you want. So countries who want to be part of the rulemaking process in the Paris Agreement have to ratify before 2018, whilst they're going to be excluded from decision making. So that's the analysis that's come. But it doesn't change the pressure that we are under to ratify before 30 days before 20 January next year.
I wonder why the COP22 has been moved from December to November. It's early November. Is it?
Yeah, there's no agenda. It's just the UN timetabling system. Okay. We knew that this was in November 4 years ago.
Oh, okay. Yeah. It was normally takes place in December. Mm-hmm. That's why even we're thinking that our colloquium on climate change will be in November. Mm-hmm. So that we can look at the issues before.
Yeah. Sure. There is another conference of the biodiversity committee that late in November. Yes, in Mexico.
Yeah.
So again, in terms of this UN, that meeting happens every 2 years. Is it 2 years? Mm-hmm. 2 years. Unlike the Climate Change Conference of Parties, takes place every year as an annual. So I guess they then pushed it forward also in consideration of that. And I'm also noting, I mean, I was talking to Judy now, that Parliament is going to be rising or in recess sometime in October and November. So
we're back in October. We're rising actually this week. Next week is just over 5 weeks.
Okay.
And then we're back again in October.
Okay.
And then we'll be rising sometime in November.
Okay. So just work backwards, then we're thinking that if Kanet is able to process the ratification instrument, then it will be tabled first week or so in October for consideration by Parliament.
Yeah.
So it would be useful if it will fit in the strategic programming of Parliament, but again, that's something we don't have control over.
Okay. All right, thanks for the presentation. I think members are itching to jump in and engage. Look, for me, I think I was not there last day in Paris, but from the feedback that I got is that South Africa played a catalytic role in brokering that agreement. It was one of the countries which was significant in the negotiation process of the Paris Agreement. So, in fact, even people acknowledge it in international platforms that had it not been for the role that South Africa plays, the Paris Agreement would not have emerged in the manner that it was finally agreed to. So, I don't think we can play such a critical role in brokering this agreement and then be the last ones to ratify. If you see, you say that the consultative stakeholder, what is this? Stakeholder consultation was done. The socio-economic impact has been concluded.
We have to submit to
presidency
for finalization.
Yes, and then from there you can do. So all the preparatory work in terms of putting the process through the cabinet and then ultimately to parliament has been completed. So I guess it would be better if I doubt if we'll be able to do it before the COP22, but if you are able to put it through, DG, I think we must utilize that opportunity so that by the time the South African delegation attends the COP22, where is it happening?
Morocco. Mm.
So the other one of my delegations in Mexico, the other one is in Morocco.
Mm-hmm.
And all of them require South Africa's attendance.
Mm.
Okay, honourable members, I hope you have been taking notes. So let's engage. Honourable Kader.
Thank you very much, Chair. I would like to thank the department for this appreciation for the TOT DJ for the work you have done so far. I was really keen to know where we are in the domestic issues or rectifying the Paris Agreement. I'm really, really happy that you are on top of the game. That was the main question for me. But when it comes to home, I would like to know, I will do a follow-up. Remember some time ago, the industries requested that they be given a sanction in complying with the minimum emission standards. Are we monitoring if they will come 2020 be able to comply with minimum emission standards? And the second question that I would like to pose as well, I don't know, as it was announced on the media some time ago, that the ESCOM board, I don't want to mention someone's name, said that it will no longer sign any further power purchase agreements. Renewables, which I think works towards against our efforts in reducing the carbon footprint in the country, especially the solar and power, because that's when we submitted our INDC and then we'll comply with it, we will reduce our carbon footprint. How does that affect our INDC that we submitted? And then the other one. Okay, you've also responded to that one. the loss and damage. I know that the country is currently facing the drought situation. Are we able to tap on that funding for the loss and damage ahead, you mentioned, or it's only going to be effective after the 55% emitters put through their instrument of ratification? I think I'll leave the rest to the colleague, to my colleague. I think those three will be my questions.
Okay, thanks, Honorable Kaga. Honorable Makure.
Thanks, Chairperson. Thanks for the presentation. It's a very difficult issue, but I think that we have traveled or traversed some distance by now. What I might have got well, and I think it needs to be clarified, when we're dealing with this subject, there's the culprits and the victims, isn't it, in terms of these countries. It's in the interest of the victims to get this ratified. But in the past, the culprits were not coming to the party, isn't it? Now, the big persons who play a major role and happen to be the culprits seem to be quick, or have been quick to ratify. What could be the situation? What motivated them? And I think the congresses and so on, the political pressures they may be having. But also, are we able to mobilize the victim countries to ratify quickly, because it's in their favor anyway. And if they are not coming to the party to make the 55%, what could be the reason? Because I thought they should not be delaying, because it's in their interest to get this signed, not even trying to ratify, so that at least that party to decision making and so on. You will respond to that, because to me, I think that is the major question that we could be facing. We think we have not scaled up investments, or we need to scale up investments into these issues of climate change as the country. And at some point, if this thing loses momentum, I'm not sure. Or perhaps some of us major participation in it is when you make presentations here. Or other than that, it's like this thing loses its thing. You know, because it's something that we should be nationally running and not lose the focus at any given point. So, that's partly because economically the economy is not performing that well. We get to affect this program as well. But I thought we should be pushing it. In Paris, what is the situation in terms of this reduction? The aim or objective is to reduce these emissions to 2% global, isn't it? 2 degrees. Yeah, 2 degrees. Yes, limit that and the further reduction to 1.5 and so on. With those patches which were there, are we closer to that kind of 2 degrees objective, or we still a bit far? Or are we able to tear with the intended nationally determined contributions? Are we able to tell how far in terms of all those submissions by these countries, and what could be the gap, and what is being done to close that particular gap? Perhaps let me leave it there.
Okay. Honorable Edward.
Sorry, sir, thank you. I'll be quick. I just quickly want to find out, it was slide 10, says there that you'll have to increase the pace of the implementation. And then one bullet or two bullets down, you also say that all spheres of government will need to refine the strategies for adapting to the impact of climate change and for the enhancing of capacity of institutions, services, infrastructure, human settlements, and ecosystem services to respond to and bounce back from the impacts of climate change. I think I'm still in election mode because I'm still thinking about local government. And I know it's been a challenge, especially in environment all over, environmental affairs, the department, you know, really want to monitor, when you want to monitor locally, because I mean, my head tells me that it makes sense to start from the bottom up in such a situation, but maybe it's the other way around, so maybe just a little bit. What I basically want to know is that how you guys are planning to do this, like the implementation, the monitoring, are you giving like incentives, etc. Because I mean, you know, it's easy to get a from above, you know, tell everybody down below, listen, do 1, 2, and 3, and they're like, oh, whatever, we don't have money, or whatever. So, and then also, I would like to know, I think Honourable David had a touch on the low carbon thing, but are you working together with other departments, specifically with regard to basically your outcomes for reaching your goals for competency
and community. I know that there's going to, this October there's going to be climate change and air quality conference of the department. Mm-hmm. What is the objective of that in relation to COP21 outcomes? What is the relation? Is it going to be enhancing or doing some impetus in terms of either implementation or whatever? What are you think to achieve in relation to this particular these outcomes?
Hello, Hadi.
The last one, Chief President. I think my colleague, Honorable Edwards, mentioned very, something very critical. The other spheres of government. I don't know what strategy the department intends to implement in ensuring that they capacitate these municipalities. Mm. Because if it's like your local spheres of government, your councillors, it's not in the IDP, it doesn't get budgeted for. So it will be like something on the pie that we are trying to fight climate change in country, but it's not implemented locally, it won't happen. So I'm thinking maybe, do you have any strategies? I know there is something which is called Let's Respond Toolkit, which you try to, by all means, capacitate the municipality, the councillor. But I think you need to strategize in getting SACAL involved, because that's a body which also does the training for councillors. We really need to have everyone on board in order to fight this in the country. I think these are, I would like to hear from your side, the strategies that you implement in ensuring that our INDC are achieved. Thank you so much.
Okay. For my right, just want to find out who are the other countries that contribute significantly towards global emission. And us also as one of the, we contribute 1.4%. Who are the biggest polluters, for instance, in the country, in South Africa, domestically? The first question is about the countries. The second one is about who are the drivers who contribute towards making us to be 1.4. That is that from my side. But just to say, I don't want to answer question because I'm not a department. But where I'm sitting, and having listened to Obama in particular, because America is one of the biggest contributors towards this, it looks like it's his legacy. One, because reduction of climate change is something which all progressives throughout the world would aspire to have. So this seemed to be Obama's legacy, that's why there was an executive thing to ratify. But we can't labor the point that South Africa has to do everything else in its power to make sure that we ratify before the end of the year. More so than China, because from the Kyoto Protocol, the biggest polluters were not coming to the party. Now we've got the Paris Agreement, they're not even coming, they're not only coming to the party, but they are leading. So, thanks. DG?
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Members, DG. I'll go through the questions, and if there's any very difficult ones, pass some of them. All right, so let's start. Honourable Hadebe, you asked about the minimum emission standards and the postponement decisions that were adjudicated 2 years ago, and are companies complying? The minimum emission standards are particularly in relation to sulfur dioxide, the NOxes, so those are the air pollutants that really affect people's health. We are doing compliance monitoring and compliance reporting, and we are working with companies and pushing companies to conclude on the offset proposals and developments that were included in their plans, because they had to submit a plan of how they were going to remain within the minimum emission standards for 2020. So to some extent, the minimum emission standards relating to those pollutants they have a relationship to the greenhouse gas emission reduction effort in that they are co-benefits. When you reduce greenhouse gas emissions, then you also have a reduction in many instances, not in all, but you do have a reduction potentially in sulfur dioxide and in the NOxes and the particulate matter that affects people's breathing. But those air pollutants are not necessarily the issues that are being addressed through our work under climate change, but obviously there's a very close relationship. I must say that we are starting to apply more pressure on those companies that received the postponement decisions, because we have heard indirectly and no formal communication, but we have heard that there are companies that are already indicating that they are going to seek additional postponement. And from our perspective, that is just a non-starter. So we are sending the signal very clearly that that is a non-starter. Companies made a commitment. That commitment is in paper. That commitment is written down in their pollution prevention planning. And the whole purpose of that postponement process was to enable companies to make the transition and to plan their transition and to take whatever action, whether it was retrofitting of clean technologies or whatever plans they needed to take to reduce their emissions to remain within the minimum emission standards, that stands. So that's the status of the minimum emission standards. I think that we will be hearing more from that, and I would suggest that we work a little bit further with our compliance team, and then we would be able to report, Honourable Chair, to you and your committee on the status. I think I'll answer the question on the Eskom board statement very lightly, DG, and you could perhaps come in there. I think the point is that South Africa's Renewable Energy Independent Power Producer Program is really quite a flagship in our efforts in reducing emissions. And also, I think the reality in any kind of economic transition process, such as the one that that South Africa is facing, there are always bound to be practical challenges. And to some extent, I think Eskom has raised a practical challenge. And that challenge is related to the fact that the agreement signed required them to purchase the renewable energy that is produced at any time of the day or night. So often the wind blows at night, and there is wind energy power being produced at a time when South Africa is not necessarily needing that power. So what we are doing is we are doing some research work with the CSIR and coming up with some solutions to these challenges that Eskom is facing, and then we would work with DG to engage with the Department of Public Enterprises, the Department of Energy, and through those departments to with Eskom around what is within the solution space to deal with, I think, what to some extent is a technical challenge, and maybe other more complicated challenges, which I need to teach you to respond on that. The question on the on loss and damage. The loss and damage mechanism was actually concluded in Warsaw. It's called the Warsaw WIMP, the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage. In fact, Mr. Bolerka played a very, very key role in facilitating conclusion of the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage. The big challenge with that mechanism is this very, very complex negotiation issue of compensation and liability, because obviously it doesn't matter which of the multilateral agreements we're talking about, the question of cross-border liability and compensation is a very, very thorny issue. So the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage has worked at this stage around that matter and has looked at processes of support to countries that are experiencing loss and damage that may not necessarily be directly related to liability and compensation. That said, the mechanism is still in the process of finalizing its modality so that it is fully operational. But I think it's important also to say that there is funding available from various sources to support impacts such as drought impacts. Those sources on South Africa has not applied in our drought situation for international funding support, because I think at this stage what is more important for us is that we see the drought in the context of longer term cyclical climate variability within the country, and needing to locate that drought and learn the lessons from a planning perspective as to what the drought is telling us and what it means, where we are vulnerable. And that, if I may just leap onto the question, I'll be very quick, Honourable Chair, onto the question of provincial and local adaptation planning. The department is really doing extensive work in supporting provinces around their vulnerability assessment to understand where they are vulnerable, where provinces in a geographical location are more or less likely to be vulnerable from a drought perspective, from a temperature perspective, from a flooding perspective. We're also working with organizations like the Agricultural Research Council in terms of crop suitability studies, where with changing temperatures and with reducing rainfall, are our crops likely to be vulnerable, and what do we do about that? So in response to the question around are we working with a national department, yes. The department really has a key role in convening national departments around climate change response. So whether it's around food security, water security, health security, biodiversity security, we have the responsibility of making the interlinkages. And then energy comes into that because there's a water element, particularly whether it's in terms of coal-fired energy generation or other energy technologies, there is a water implication there. So yes, we are working with other departments in that respect. Honourable Makabele, you asked about countries that are not coming to the party to ratify the BRICM countries. I think perhaps, in Africa we only have, so far we have two, and I think we have a third coming to the table soon. I think that's more more about their parliamentary processes and their processes for getting the ratification through their own domestic procedures. Really, as I said earlier, we did not expect this, the haste with which the early entry into force would come on the table. And so I think to some extent countries have been caught slightly by surprise. I don't think there is any reason, there's no agenda around not wanting to ratify, because the sooner countries ratify, the better for them in terms of support, certainly developing countries. In terms of the retained staying within the 2 degrees warming or intensifying or reducing even further to 1 degree warming, 1.5 degree warming, are we able to tell how close we are to that? The work that has been done so far in the UNFCCC through the Secretariat of adding up the collective or the aggregate outcome of the nationally determined contributions is not very positive. It indicates that as such we, with all the pledges on the table at the moment, we are probably within a 3 degree warming world, 3 to 5 degree warming, but they've really said 3 degree warming world, so we are overshooting really what is required. The UN Environment Programme does an emissions gap report once every year, and that emissions gap report indicates what is required of global efforts to stay within the 2 degrees. At this stage, it shows that we need 44 gigatons. We have a 44 gigaton space, and at the moment we're within the 56. Okay.
Gigatons. Are you done? I want to ask for record.
I think, I'm not sure if I can just say the drivers. So there was a question around the drivers of South Africa's greenhouse gas emissions. And I think the critical thing is that the energy sector in South Africa is 42% of our total greenhouse gas emissions. Transport is over, yeah.
Yes, just touching on that, I mean, the greenhouse gas is generated through carbon dioxide emissions and also methane and other gases. But those are the main ones. And coal burning industries, and which then is what we use in terms of mostly energy generation from Eskom, because they, and then liquid fuels or petrochemicals, transport emissions which come from the exhaust fumes, there are efforts for South Africa to lower lead inclusion in fuel and other refinement now with respect to fuel standards and fuel specifications. Landfill sites generate the methane in terms of waste, so that is an area which falls under GL's ambit, but the others are more contributions from other sectors, like also deforestation is small in South Africa, but it still contributes a little bit. But as Judy was saying, make those available. And just to add that for Honourable Khadiri, the greenhouse gas then emissions are different from the air quality emissions, which is what Judy was explaining, because they were talking about nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, and others, and particulate matter, which is what is significant. Also coming from the same industries, in a sense. And then lastly, I thought I should comment on the question on in respect of power purchase agreements with renewables. In terms of policy in South Africa, the energy plan, which is a 2010 plan, outlines, I mean, the policies of South Africa in terms of our posture. We have an energy policy that has what is focused on mixed energy options, and it includes a contribution by renewables, contribution that includes nuclear, and also some of the and coal, clean coal in future, because there's also research work that is going to carbon capture and storage, so that we limit the emissions that go into the atmosphere, and that is led by the Department of Energy, the Research Institute, Sanedi, and working with other partners. So in reality, it's not an either or. So the issue of renewables, there's a set percentage that is applied to the energy plan that should help South Africa transition. And therefore, we have to probably understand what some of the challenges that Eskom has in respect of now that the economy is not growing, we are on a low economic production scenario. And if the economy pick up tomorrow, whether Eskom would be saying the same thing. Because last year when we had more blackouts, every megawatt mattered, whether. So both on energy security, from an energy security point of view, and also from a clean energy and low carbon transition point of view, renewables are still very important, and they may be instruments that would have to be considered between treasury and energy around the clauses that could be part of the power purchase agreement in respect of what can be done to mitigate the cost when you are on a low growth scenario versus an upgrade to the growth scenario. So I'm not going to get into whether the CE was right or wrong, but there are those principles, and my understanding is that the ministers of energy, the public enterprises, and our minister are supposed to have the meeting and discussion so that we are on one message in respect of that. Thanks.
Sorry, Honourable Chair, let me correct something. The power sector, electricity sector is the 42%. The energy sector, electricity is 42%. Energy total is closer to 80%. The industrial is 8%, agriculture is 9%, and waste is close to 4%. But I'll send you the numbers.
What we need to do, Honourable Members, we must engage with Eskom, because I was also taken aback when the chief executive made that announcement. I know for a fact that it's not part of our policy, because our policy talks about the energy mix. And when you similarly almost obliterate this renewable energy, the independent power producers, you don't sign the agreement, that you are basically killing them. And our contributions towards clean energy then drops. So I think we must engage with the school to understand where we're coming from, but also to appreciate the bigger picture towards reduction of global emissions. And this program is assisting in that regard. So I don't know what are the difficulties, because the DG did not talk about them. But I guess you don't want to talk about them.
Well, there's one specific matter about availability during peak and versus non-peak, because their plants operate like 24/7 when you have a generation from coal power plants. And where his argument is saying renewables, the sun is only during the day and wind at times does not blow. The issue is what the storage capacity availability and technologies, and who can invest in those technologies, because as part of the process of renewables, we have had discussions and there are options for storage, and it can also be pushed back to the private sector for that matter, that they must then store the energy and make it available these times, and it's possible that they can make such an investment because such technologies are available. So the discussion, when it happens there in the air, we don't quite know the issues, and we would they are solutions, and certainly even if we talk coal today, there are other challenges that coal has, and both in terms of water use problems, let alone the emissions, which we need to confront and certainly have clear abatement plans for into the future. So those discussions can happen, honourable members, and certainly we are not saying no to nuclear, because Quebec currently is one source of nuclear that has given some level of security, and it is cheaper base load electricity over time. But the question is, how do you invest in it? You can still have an IPP even on that, probably. So it's not, that's why I think fundamentally, the problem is when you start saying either nuclear or renewables, those solutions, you can explore all of them, both in terms of your affordability, but also, and renewables have been going down in terms of price from the initial investment into the future. Of course, you have 20-year contracts because the private party also wants to recover its cost. And the question is, what is the best solution? What is the best, if they say we have a challenge when we have abundance of energy and we still have to pay for it? The question is, exactly who's paying? Because Eskom still gets a price, a cut out of the price that you pay for on renewables. So they are not losing anything really. But we can have a discussion.
Yeah, let's have the discussion. Let's have the discussion, Eskom. There is eagerness to move towards a nuclear, which is clean also, but the cost associated with that. It's something that whether the council will be able to afford at the pace at which they are anticipating. So I think we will invite them as soon as we come back to engage. When is the conference that the honourable?
Oh yes, the air quality conference is not the climate change conference. We have an air quality booklet.
Oh, air quality.
Which then talks to both the issues of capacity of local governments and whether the industry is ready to comply and all of those related matters. It is not directly linked to the climate change conference of parties. I think that is the response. And finally, honourable members and chair, on nuclear, on the mitigation work, nuclear is one of the most in terms of the technical potential to reduce and mitigate our emissions, it is one of those energy sources that would make us meet our long-term objectives of transitioning. But we are not getting to the debate of affordability. We're just talking now first in respect of climate change mitigation. So that's why we say the CEO of Eskom, cannot go up there and say, we support nuclear versus renewables, because that's, we've outlined what is the contribution of renewables in terms of the technical potential for mitigation and what other sources of energy like nuclear contributes in that respect. And therefore, we can also present a discussion if honourable members would want to have a discussion in that respect.
We'll have a discussion with Eskom, definitely. And we'll also ask the department then to give us that presentation on their side. I thought there's only one. It's like you've got two presentations. But I saw something on the about the preparation for what was there? Oh, it was the same one. Oh, okay. Oh, yes.
Well, just to conclude, TG, I think we were all saying we're urging the department to try and analyze this process of getting ratification through the cabinet, approval through cabinet, and then processing it through parliament. I'm sure parliamentary programming committee will understand the agency of the matter if we do a proper presentation to them, so that if possible during the next parliamentary term we are able to get approval. I think that would be very much appreciated. So we are done with that. We are ready for the next one, family. Deputy Chair, I don't know what how do you want us to approach this thing. Will the CEO will make a presentation?
Yes, the CEO would make a presentation, Chair. It's a presentation of our performance for the last quarter of 2015-16 and the first one of 2016-17, showing our KPIs and how we performed against those. You see in the slides that I've got amount that we did very well in the last end of the year, financial year, Chair. So we came through 98% of the KPIs we sent on, and we are slightly below the current ones, but we still need it financially, so we believe we'll be able to meet those, Chair. Yes.
Okay, CEO.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. It's nice to be here. My name is Tanya Abramsa, and I'm the CEO, and with me is Lorato Sitole, who is the Chief Financial Officer. And next to her is Carmelin Bizo, who is Head of Science and Policy in Sandy. And next to her is Moketsi Kwati, Mr. Moketsi Kwati, who is our Chief Corporate Officer. Again, to indicate that Mrs. Makumula, her husband, Gabby Makumula, had to go into an emergency operation yesterday. And we were very pleased that Dr. Majila could come very last minute to come and escort us here to the portfolio committee. The next slide, please. Just to say the presentation outline, some of our honourable members are new and some are not so new, and I hope that we don't get bored of me repeating some of the explanation about who Sandy is. The presentation outline would like to show you our background and policy and legal framework, the legislative and policy mandate that we work under, our contribution to national priorities, and then our programs, and in more detail, as deputy chair of our board indicated, we will talk to you about our annual target of quarter four, which essentially is the end of that financial year, 15-16. And on the same slide, which might be a little bit confusing, so I might have gone through the slides twice, on the same slide, we will talk about the achievements in quarter one of 16-17. And then just to anticipate some of the questions have been asked previously, Honourable Chair. We will show you some figures around our staff demographics in the presentation, which you might be interested in. And then I'm going to ask Ms. Sitole to take us through the financials and our performance for the 15-16 external audit outcome and our financial performance in quarter one, very briefly. So just to remind colleagues that we are the South African National Biodiversity Institute. We are one of four public entities under the Environment Affairs Department. We are an odd organization because essentially we do three key things. We run a national botanical garden system. We're going from 9 to 10 national botanical gardens and getting a national footprint in the next few years. In addition, we provide biodiversity research and information for the state and for other organs of state as well as the citizens of South Africa. So essentially, and the third area that we work on, which is a mandate area, is the issue around human capital development in our sector. And it was interesting listening to some of the discussions yesterday about the rhino and about the, about scientists, especially the last young lady who talked about the history of conservation and biodiversity protection in our country. And so that we have a deficit there, so we are responsible for growing the human capital development, overcoming those differentials that we inherit in South Africa. So our mission is, before you go to the next slide, our mission is to champion the exploration, conservation and sustainable use and appreciation, enjoyment of this amazing rich biodiversity for all our people. We're the third most biodiverse country in the world, and so that our aim would be to ensure that this rich biodiversity actually contributes to our development goals. So our policy and legal framework, many of you have seen this before. We are created through the National Biodiversity Act, NEMBA, as it's called, the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act of 2004. But just to indicate that the organization itself comes from 100 years old, started ironically in 2014, during the time of the Land Act, 1914, during the time of the Land Act, with the creation of Kirstenbosch as a national botanical garden, and has evolved over time to the point of 2004 when it was enshrined in Act, the Member Act, and that indicates in very broad strokes what is our mandate as an institution. We also subsequently play roles in regulations that come out under that Act, especially in threatened and protected species, and we play the role of the National Scientific Authority that provides advice to the Minister on CITES, the trade in endangered species discussion we had yesterday. In addition to that, we also deal with invasive species, especially in terms of providing the research and background and rationale for actions to be taken by the department and other departments on invasive species. We have obligations in the National Biodiversity Strategic Action Plan, which, as you know, is a 20-year vision passed through Cabinet, and in the National Biodiversity Framework, which is a 5-year chunk of that 20-year vision. So, and do say, Amut Chair, if there's any documentation that you need, including things like the INCAP, which is actually in the process of being revised at this minute. We also have obligations in the Minister Delivery Agreement in Outcome 10 and in the Medium-Term Strategic Framework Targets, which have been published and Parliament approved. And then in addition to that, we have taken on responsibility when the White Paper on Climate Change came out, and our role is to deliver the science behind the long-term adaptation strategies for the biodiversity world, for the bio-natural resource world. And in addition to that, we are also leading adaptation work on climate change through the fact that we are the national implementing entity for the Global Adaptation Fund. And all of these are various mandates over and above the mandate originally given when the National Environmental Management Biodiversity Act was created in 2004. Next slide, please. As sort of very difficult to explain what we do, and this is a graphic explanation, what we do is really lead the foundations of biodiversity research. We are the holders of the national collections on plants. We engage with those who are involved with the collections on animals. We lead the taxonomy research, either harnessing other institutions. We work with many other institutions in the research around developing the foundations of biodiversity. We hold the maps and inventories of ecosystems and species for the country. We then build on that knowledge by doing assessments and develop views around the status and the trends and the monitoring and modeling. Our big document, the National Biodiversity Assessment, which we produced in 2011, and we do produce another one, another major one in 2018. The National Biodiversity Assessment is a key document that gives Minister advice on the directions on managing biodiversity. And so we have relationships with Sandparks, for example, with Isimangaliso, with all national, all provincial parks and conservation areas, in terms of having a sense about how do we manage this amazing asset of biodiversity. The third area that we work in is really taking some of these learnings into action, and we do a number of pilots, we develop models. One of the models we developed from the research we did was to develop a guideline for mining 2 years ago, biodiversity guideline for mining. We did that together with the Chamber of Mines, for example. The other thing, and we hope very much that you will sometimes attend some of these, we have an annual biodiversity information management forum where we're really looking at building the capacity at provincial, at local, and at institutional level, and all reading off the same song sheet around biodiversity information management. We also do the same with planning. We have a planning forum once a year that brings together all the biodiversity planning of planners of the country, and getting bigger and bigger. So that's some of the things we do. And we, at the same time, as I indicated, an area which everybody thinks is the only thing we do is to run the National Botanical Gardens. We have, at the minute, 10 going on 11. Last year, we opened Quelea National Botanical Garden in the Eastern Cape. So, Kersebosch, Betty's Bay, Worcester, Huntam, Free State, Lowveld in Nelspruit, Pretoria, Walter Sisulu, the opening
Toyando.
The new one is Toyando.
And so is Kolefa
in the Eastern Cape.
Those are recent. The Toyando one is
just now we signed this year. Yeah.
And the Kolefa one is a new one. We hosted the portfolio committee when we launched it. There was somebody
We have just passed through our governance committee, in which we will pass through a DO system, and like you to see it as well, our gardens expansion strategy going forward. We want to ensure that the gardens are in every biome of the country so that it can be representative of the plant species of every biome in South Africa. And then we also, as I say, are leading the human capital development of the biodiversity sector. So just in brief, just to show you how we support DEAR's outcomes of environmental economic contribution, our ecological integrity, our socially transformed transition communities, as well as the global agenda. And in addition, we engage with DEAR in order to support them, particularly with evidence-based information around decisions we made. So we contribute to the medium-term strategic framework and the sub-outcomes of that, and ultimately to the National Development Plan. We also are engaged as an entity, next slide please, with a number of international agreements. Some of the research that Judy mentioned around climate change modeling is our role to do. We also, of course, engage with the Convention on Biological Diversity, as well as on the Global Biodiversity Information Facility. We lead Africa's efforts in that international arena, and in the end, obviously, want to contribute and do contribute to sustainable development goals that was agreed in the last year by the UN. Next slide, please. So, in order to get our arms around the many, very many things we do, we have divided up into six programs. The first program is always the one around corporate services, which is national strategy regulation that it should be the top of your programs. The second program is really around the National Botanical Gardens, mainly to unlock the benefits of this network. The third is to build the foundational biodiversity science. The fourth is taking that science into assessing, monitoring, and reporting on the state of biodiversity, including to improve decision-making around adaptation to climate change. The fifth is to provide policy advice and access to biodiversity information for the state, for our ministry, for our department, for the state, for other organizations, other departments in government. We work with almost all departments that engage in one way or the other with science, with the natural environment, including science and technology, agriculture, the energy department, Department of Rural Development, etc. And the sixth area expresses our commitment around human capital development, And here it's not only human capital development of Sandy itself, but also human capital development in the sector. And some of your colleagues here, Honourable Chair, would been told about some of the projects we've been doing in the human capital area, including Groen Sabenza and Green Atta, which are ways of grappling with the deficit that we have in our sector around capabilities and capacities in the human capital arena. So,
to interrupt, maybe the CEO can just share with you the numbers that we put through the concerns that we think it's a good program in terms of job creation and bringing the youth into the employment sector. So I think it's sort of changing the health and the organization by giving one line on it. Maybe you can give you the extent of the numbers and the people that are now in formal employment, thanks to the Prince for the program that's on that side.
Just very quickly, we in the biodiversity sector, which includes state organisations as well and all the provinces as well as NGOs and the private sector, it is a common cause that we struggle with getting skilled young people into our sector. And this is a legacy of the education, a legacy of us not selling the sector as an exciting sector. And at the same time, it's a growing sector. If you look at some of the climate change challenges that we've got, including some of the national and international ambitions that we have around a green economy, one of the big things is the deficit of skills, and particularly the deficit of young skills. And what we found was we were all competing. And in fact, here I've stolen some of our best people to take into their organization. We've stolen some of their best people. So it was a great competition over very few skills, and particularly young people. And so we made an intervention and went to the Job Fund. And in the end, we managed to take over 900 young people, of which 500 of them were unemployed graduates. Can you imagine, in a country we have unemployed graduates? We took them through a two-year incubation process, which in the end, 650 or so of them got permanent jobs in our sector, which just was an indication of the need, the demand for skills, particularly in all sorts of things, from water quality management to scientists, to zoologists, to assessors, to monitors, to invasive species, people who understand invasive species eradication, a whole range of potential careers for young people in what is a growing sector. It is a very difficult project to do, but I must say that these young people were amazing. They were mainly rural. 52% were women. They were like behind a seam of gold there, and they're all now contributing to the transformation and the improvement of our sector in terms of that. It was a difficult but rewarding project. So we employed them. We employed in provinces, provincial departments, who are so in need of a array of skills to do their own mandates, provincial environment departments, agriculture, many NGOs actually, WWF, organizations like that, who also compete with us as the state sector for capable people. And so it was an amazing way to change that relationship from a competitive relationship to a cooperative relationship where we together built these young people. So initially through the program, Sandy employed them. They were then in host institutions, 44 host institutions, some of them provincial governments, many of them NGOs, even some private sector. Hosted them, grew them, gave them confidence and skills, and at the end of it, many of them actually employed them.
That participation process would pay their salaries. We actually covered costs. So organizations got resources for free, but in the process they prepare people for the market. It allows for transition of people from being unemployed to being employed. I believe it's a very successful model.
Thank you, Chair. So I'm just a bit concerned about time for you. And so I wanted to just, this is a format that we were asked to report on and can be a little bit confusing. I'm suggesting that we go through the slideshow once and come back and go through it again, because otherwise it might not make sense. But you'll see without going into details.
Just give me the slide and then we're done with it.
Okay.
Because the first column is 2015-16, fourth quarter. The other one,
quarter one,
is the quarter one. Okay. So you deal with quarter four previous year, quarter one this financial year. Yeah, so you can deal with it like that.
Okay. Well, as you can see, from quarter four on the percentage of payroll, same for staff development, which is also part of our human capital development. We achieved that goal, and we are on track of achieving it in the first quarter. Is that how you want me to present it? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, well, the title is yours, as long as we have the information.
Okay.
And explain the process of price. Don't mind, whichever way you want.
Okay. One of the reasons why I thought it was the other way, but I think you might actually might be easier, is that sometimes the target for 2015-16 has slightly changed, and so you can't compare apples with apples on this slide. When we get to that point, I'll explain. Okay. So on performance indicator, the program one, which is surrender, effective and efficient corporate services, and 1.1 is that we are positioned as an employer of choice in the biodiversity sector. The first performance indicator is the percentage spent on staff development, which we achieved, and we are on track to achieve this in the first quarter. The next area is around the number of black biodiversity professionals developed through internships and postgraduate studentships. The Queen's Agenda program you mentioned earlier was a new initiative, but Sandia has for many, many years always been involved with internships and postgraduate studies. For quarter four, we achieved our target of 60 black biodiversity professionals developed through these internships and postgraduate studentships, and we haven't got a target for this quarter, but we're on track to achieve the target for this first financial year. Under the indicator position, also presented as employer of choice in the biodiversity sector, one of our indicators is we want to be a transformed institute that reflects the demography of the South African population. We have got a baseline. We achieved the targets set out in 2015-16, and we're on track to achieve our first quarter target for this year. Also under Program 1, which the CFO will talk a little bit more about, is the issue about implementing effective and efficient supply chain and financial management systems according to the PFMA. And as you can see, we achieved that target in the fourth quarter, end of the year last year, and we're on track to achieve it this year. Under Program 1, continuing to improve financial sustainability of the institution, and that's the percentage increase of income generated on rental, admission, sales, and other income. Just to remind colleagues, that our garden, our network of gardens, we have admission fees that's going through the gardens, and we also, while we don't run restaurants and facilities on it, we rent it out to people who do know how to run restaurants, and we take a slice of their income into rental. Mr. Buffy can explain a little bit more if you like. So this is a reflection of that. The reason why it's not applicable in the 2015-16 area is because we shifted this target from the gardens area to the financial area and made the CFO responsible for the increase of income rather than the gardens people, which will explain that. But this year we are in the first quarter on track with that achievement. Program 1 continues. On the next slide. Now, this is where I thought, this is the first time this has come up, this is where I thought it might get confusing, but I'll explain it on the way. The 2015-16 targets get slightly adjusted every year through consultation with the Department of Environmental Affairs and any other big issues that are coming along the way. And so sometimes you can't compare 2015-16 targets with the 2016-17 targets, and here is an example, just to say that in the 2015-16 year, the percentage availability of ICT services, we achieved that target. And here I want to just remind our colleagues how central ICT, keeping up with ICT, is in a business like ours, in the business of science, in the business of data management, especially when we are increasingly managing data for global institutions, for regional institutions on the African continent, and of course for ourselves and for our country. So the issue about ICT services being available and being at the head of the game is one of the key areas that we are happy to achieve in as a knowledge organization, including being able to provide knowledge to citizens and other organs of state. It's really important. So we achieved that target last year, and we're on track to achieve that target this year. The area around risk, as you know, becomes more and more complicated. Our target around, our indicator around risk management is there. We have achieved all the targets of last year, and we're on track to achieve the targets this year. On the issue around compliance with all relevant acts, and as you know, one of the big acts that have come up on board lately is the Health and Safety, Occupational Health and Safety Act, which anybody who runs an organization will know is quite very important, but quite an onerous thing to begin. So the issue about compliance to all relevant acts, including the Labor Relations Act, Occupational Health and Safety Act, and COPPI, for example, is really important. We achieved our target there for 2014-15-16, and we are set to achieve our target in 2016-17, the first quarter. Building a compelling brand for all stakeholders, you know, we want to get more and more visitors. We feel that we particularly are talking to urban visitors. We want to increasingly talk to urban visitors at lower income levels. And so we track what we do in this space as well as how we achieve, and we see it in the number of targets. So the number of marketing initiatives and activities to raise our brand, to promote us and to profile us is an area we take very seriously indeed, and we achieved all our targets in 2015-16, and we are on track to achieve our targets for this past quarter. Here again, if you'll notice on the top, there's a slight change between 2015-16 and 2017 first quarter. That red indicates that. So this indicator, a number of platforms that we use a whole range of platforms for internal communication, for newsletters, remembering that we are based on 11 places in the country. And so the issue about staff communication and cohesion, messaging and morale and indicating to all staff, given that our mandate is so wide, what we are doing is really important. And for that, we're glad that we achieved our target to have those internal platforms. It's not applicable because we have shifted slightly in this quarter. Performance indicates the number of public platforms used for internal communication. Again, we have achieved that, and we are on track to achieve our target for this year. Next, please. Continuing with building a compelling brand, we've had in the last year, 2015-16, a huge increase actually in the number of radio, television and print interviews and press releases and media statements, and really it's because of a number of events that drive us, that we have run in our gardens or that we have participated in, and we achieved our target last year. And as you can see, there's a slight change in this year and about how we measure ourselves. Next, please. Okay, here's gardens. We run a network of natural botanical gardens, and we want them to be managed well and maintained. And some of the elements in our gardens is to do with the science that we do. And the first target here is we want to display indigenous plants in the garden. We want to increase representation of indigenous plants. Eventually, we want all indigenous plants to be reflected in our gardens, and which is why we are expanding our national footprint. The target of 2015-16 was achieved, and our target for the first quarter was also achieved. just to go back, sorry, just to tell our colleagues, honourable members, in case they don't remember, we also are part of the Millennium Seed Bank Initiative, the Global Millennium Seed Bank Initiative, which aims to get all seeds of all plants on the earth safely stored in case of climate change, for example, or any other catastrophe or disaster or loss of genetic material. And so we are a player for Southern Africa on that Millennium Seed Bank partnership, run by Kew Gardens in the United Kingdom. Next, please. Also in this network of National Botanical Gardens, we had ambitions to grow our numbers, and we have developed a garden expansion strategy which we would very keen of you to see. And so just to indicate that we've got some milestones around our great Limpopo garden, which will be hopefully signed before this financial year, and the issues around Kwelecha. Basically we've achieved both, in both those areas we've achieved the target, and in the quarter one we've achieved the target. So it's on the way, the Toyando Garden is on the way to being one of a National Botanical Garden. Next, please. Also in the National Botanical Gardens, as you can imagine, a huge number of maintenance and capital infrastructure projects that we have done over a number of years. I'm sure if any of you visit our gardens, you see the amount of education centers that we've built in the last 10 years, the amount of attractions and also science infrastructure and research infrastructure that we've built on our campuses in the last 10 years. We achieved our target of last year, and we are on track to achieve the target that we've finished. We've achieved the first quarter target for 16-17. Next, please. I mean, as you might be interested in is the indicator around income and visitor numbers through revenue-generating activities in our gardens. And again, we've achieved our target of last year. In fact, this is an area that we have been overachieving in. And in my view, it is because of the value for money that urban people on the whole see in seeing nature on their doorstep, as opposed to taking a car and driving to a national park. So I think we are tapping a very different market with the gardens, and so we really have grown in size in terms of percentage increase of numbers to our gardens, and also because we have some discounts and some special prices for pensioners and children, etc., then the numbers have increased, but also our income has increased. Thank you, slide, please. And as I said in the previous slide, we have shifted the income to the CFO's achievements, key performance indicators. Sorry. Yeah. All right. The next area is the building the foundational biodiversity science, and I apologize for the spelling mistake there. And this is program 3, and it's really that building of the foundational information. In this area we do a lot of work, and the real difficulty we have is really developing the indicators to show the deep cutting indicators that will give you some sense of the performance and productivity of an organization like SAMBI on the science side. And so one of our indicators is about the quality control records that add to our spatial data for species. And we have achieved that target last year, and we've had some changes in our ADP 2016-17, which I'll talk about later. But so that I can talk about quarter one, and we've combined a few and separated a few targets here in the next iteration in the ADP 2016-17. The next performance indicator is around plant specimens in our herbaria. As I said, we are the national holder of the collections for plants for the country. We engage with others on the animal specimens in museums. We have relationships with all the museums that have and manage biodiversity species specimens have a relationship with us. And just in this last year, DST has designated us as the lead for biodiversity collections for the country, so that it all cements that relation even further. Here again, we've done some changes. This is a new target. We wanted to separate it. There's a target set and we're on path to achieve that target. Next slide, please. Here again, on the number of species of which information have been compiled and the number of animal species of which descriptive and classification information has been compiled, we achieve those targets. Now, this is the first time we come to a target that we're not quite achieving yet in quarter one. There are challenges, and I think I'm glad I talked to you a little bit about the issue around skills and capability and how it is a constant demand is skills in our sector. And oftentimes, when a staff member leaves, you actually have a problem with achieving a certain target. The critical measure, obviously, is to recruit a recruitment process. The irony of it is that many of our young students, pioneers, as we call them, actually are filling up the gap that we've had. So in the past, we've had quite a few challenges in this. The students, the pioneers, certainly have helped, although many of them are still inexperienced. They certainly are filling the gap in some of our issues that we've had over many years. So there's a collective measure in it. And then under the environments for which ecosystem classification system have been developed, we also achieved that target. Next, please. The number of ecosystem classification systems and maps developed for the National Biodiversity Assessment, I talked to you a little bit previously about this major document that we produce on a 5-year basis, but there's a lot of work that gets developed and engaged with here and other institutions in the meanwhile. And this is the beginning of us having developing the National Biodiversity Assessment 2018, is that what it's going to be called? This is the first term we're beginning to start that process, and we are behind schedule really about the meeting that we need to convene, which will be the overarching guider for the National Biodiversity Assessment. It's not only us at SANBI, we've included a number of players in this advisory committee, and so our first meeting will be held. So we're on track to achieve that goal, but just we didn't achieve it in quarter one. And here again, there's also been a slight change now the way our indicators are set. The numbers of national maps showing distributions of ecosystems, our goal is achieved, and there's been a change in our targets for 2016-17. Thank you. Next, please. Which is around the assessing and monitoring. Again, there's another area which we do quite a lot, and it's difficult to find an indicator. But we thought papers published in international recognized journals that's peer-reviewed would be a good way of measuring our national and international standing in terms of research. Our goal was to have 80 plus publications, and we achieved that target. In this quarter, our goal was 15 publications, and we achieved that target. This is a difficult thing sometimes to measure, because is it when the paper is accepted into an ISI journal, or when it's published for public, for when it's submitted, when it's published, when it's submitted, when it's accepted, or when it's published. And so we've had little discussions about what would be the best measure, and so that improvement needs to be made, and we need to modify the targets halfway through the year to accommodate that clarity. Also, we need to correct it, because we're actually going to overachieve in this area, and so we want to make the target higher for the 2016-17 financial year. Next, please. The next is the National Biodiversity Assessment 2018 is the major national scientific synthesis and assessment report that we produce. The last one we produced 2011 was deemed by the Minister and our Minister Molewa, as well as the OECD, as being world's best practice national biodiversity assessment. And so it was very successful. We want to build on that success. We achieved all the things we wanted to achieve in 2015-16 and on track to achieve in quarter one. Next, please. This is a continuation of the previous one. It's just a lot of issues, lots of baseline stuff we put in there. We part of the National Scientific Synthesis is our role as the GMO genetically modified organisms advisor to the state, and our work there, we have achieved what we want to achieve in quarter one. Thanks. Continuing with the number of national synthesis and assessment reports, we, as I said, indicated we achieved what we wanted to do in 2015-16, but in quarter one, quarter one 2016-17, we're a little bit behind, and I'm going to ask my colleague from who's head of science to explain a little bit how we are behind. And with your guidance, Honourable Chair, can she do it now, or shall we wait at the end? Okay. Alright. So I'll ask her to explain if we are decided we want to do a national assessment of spider species of South Africa and why we changed, and of course we changed through to via because of a request to do something else. Next, please. Continue with the national assessment services. We are the red list, IUCN's red list partner in terms of assessments. We achieved doing a comprehensive work around the mammals red list. Red list is about threatened species, threatened species. So we achieved our target of last year, 2015-16. The next one is the annual updates of species assessment to support member regulations. Again, we achieved our targets, particularly the invasive species work that we do with the Department of Environment Affairs. We do the science for understanding invasive species, as well as the work we do with the scientific authority on the non-detrimental findings of the scientific authority, and we achieved both all of that last year. Thank you. Again, here's the number of annual updates. We've just included it into the target, to the previous target now. The number of updates is non-detrimental findings. Again, it's part of our achievement, and the target issues identified, and we are on track to achieve that in the first year, the first quarter. Again, I'll ask my colleague to explain this. We do a number of large, you know, there's over 2 million cooperative research assessment programs that have delivered knowledge and data, and our baseline last year was the three large research assessments that we've been doing, one on marine, the other one on invasives, and the other one was the work we've been doing on identifying the biodiversity species gaps, particularly in support of the SIP program, the government SIP program. And we achieved all our targets there, but in the first quarter, we are a bit behind schedule. We are waiting approval from DRNRM, but it's not DRNRM's fault why we are late here. I just want to tell you, Chair. This was a much more complicated operation for invasive species that we thought, and so we have put in the program proposal late. And so I don't want you to think that it was them who's delaying, because our relationship here is a very efficient one indeed, actually. Program, can next slide, please? Okay, program five is the work that we do, providing tools, pilots, to show how to do biodiversity better. So it's tools to support management and conservation of biodiversity. And our first indicator is the number of tools to support mainstreaming. And there's a huge baseline here, and it would be really useful for you to see by that baseline of the work that is the background to Sambia and the work that we've been doing and the kinds of tools that we've been producing. and the core of hazard was having 2 and 3 knowledge resources, and we achieved both of them in 2015-16. There's no target for that in the first quarter this year, but the one on the knowledge resource development, we are on target for this quarter. Next slide, please. This area really, you know, when we talk about capacity building, we often think it's about incubation, internships, scholarships, but in this area of work, I think we are unable to actually measure the amount of capacity development we do through some of these coordinated learning mechanisms and forums that we run. And this year we want to particularly focus on provincial and municipal and other relevant decision makers. We've always been focusing on it, but but this year we want to particularly measure ourselves against that. If you look at our baseline, you'll see the work we've done previously. Those were the quarters. We achieved the quarters, and we're on track to achieve the we achieved the targets, and we're on track in the first quarter to achieve the top. Next, please. Also in this area of policy and advice is around data and information knowledge provided. I think I indicated that we are mandated through our act to lead, provide access to biodiversity data for organs of state as well as the citizens. So the issue around biodiversity records collected and published, we've added that this year. We achieved it in 2015-16. And I think because we've added an additional criteria to our target from last year, we are behind schedule, and my colleague will talk about that again. It's gone, and we'll talk about the challenges in that space if we've got time. Next, please. And then users of registered users on our biodiversity advisor, and I want to just ask colleagues, please, it would be really grateful if you could go into biodiversity advisor if you haven't, and give us feedback on the usefulness from all angles that this tool has, that we think is useful, but you know, people who develop things always think it's useful. We really would like to get that. We achieved the targets of last year. Also program 5, which is this is a very busy program, I must say. We basically go through all requests from the Department of Environmental Affairs, from provinces, from municipalities, and particularly other organs of state, to make comments and to mainstream biodiversity issues. So, for example, I have just signed off for the marine and coastal comments from Stanley. We would comment on land reform. We would comment on agriculture. We would comment on, we don't comment on the fracking issue. We're providing the science and data for the decision, the strategic environmental assessment of the fracking program, for example. But this is when, and it's just part of our role as a public entity to ensure that that any document that might impact, or any policy that might impact on environment and biodiversity passes through our hands and we have some comment on. And so this has been a very interesting thing, also to understand what other departments are doing and other policies are doing, so that we can make sure that there's a biodiversity and environment element in it, and we achieve all the targets there, we're on track to achieve the targets going forward. Okay, this is the area I talked about the national implementing entity. About 3-4 years ago, the minister requested that we go to be the national implementing entity for the Global Adaptation Fund. It's been a very interesting journey. We have projects in Ngungu Ndlovu Municipality, in Namakwa, in the Tsanin area, and I'm trying to think of the other one, but we have, through development of adaptation projects with our colleagues at municipal level mainly, we have managed to do some amazing work, not only in the biodiversity sector, but also in agriculture, housing, and water management, riverine management, because adaptation is difficult to do adaptation just in one sector. But because we're the national implementing entity of the Global Adaptation Fund, we've got some very interesting topics, and I would really be grateful, Chair, if you could find time at some, I know that you've got a very busy agenda, if you could ask us to come and make a presentation on this adaptation project. And it's very relevant, I think, because we are pioneering these adaptation projects as part of the adaptation work of the Climate Change Department, and they sit on our steering committee, that we've had a number of NIE steering committees. In addition, the Minister has also requested that we apply for the Green Climate Fund going forward, but we have already received the $10 million for this adaptation fund project from the Green Plan, from the Global Adaptation Fund. But I really would, if there was one thing I would want to ask you, is for us to come and tell you about that program. Then also under Program 5 is the work we do with ecosystem-based adaptation tools, and here this is in support for the framework for the department. And we've achieved all the targets and fulfilled all their requests around this matter. We also have developed tools for climate change adaptation and have mainstreamed it. And that we are, it's a new target. It wasn't there last time. And we are achieving our targets for the first quarter of this year. Next, please. Program 6 is a human capital development, which where our Prince Benza project was part of. This is, we take this area of our work very seriously, and you know, you don't know where to start. So one of the things we decided to start with was to engage with teachers and student teachers that teach biodiversity at school age, and we call it foundation building. And we do this together with an organization that we were part of forming. And so 600 teachers and 600 student teachers have been exposed to our conservation education. And we, in fact, exceeded our target here this year. A huge demand for our teachers. We do this together with the Department of Basic Education as well as the Department of Environmental Education, Chief Director. And we achieved all our targets in this space. The next area is supporting graduates and practitioners and leaders, and we do this with our Green Matter, which is an organization we created with a funder, and through this 50 graduates and practitioners have been supported through this development program, and the results are amazing, actually. Oftentimes, fellows find that they are out there in the world without any support and often don't achieve because of that, and so we achieved our targets in 15-16 in this area. Next, please. So here this is the last time you'll see the Frun Sabenza in this kind of way, the number of individuals involved in our Green Work Program, 800 individuals, that was our baseline, 800 individuals. In the end, it was 1,000 unemployed youth skilled and hosted in the biodiversity sector. That 1,000 includes some of the other interns, etc., but and other job creation initiatives. So we've exceeded the targets there in that space. And as you see, from 16-17, that target has been taken off, and we've recrafted it into another target in the human capital space. The other area that we have been engaged with is universities in producing stronger skills. What we find is that universities produce scientists, botanists, biologists, zoologists, but they don't produce people who actually are ready for work in institutions like ours, which are really about project planning management, information management, a whole array of more nuanced skills that is needed in our sector. And so we've engaged with 10 universities, including particularly formerly disadvantaged universities, who achieved our target in this. Thanks. Next slide, please. As part of the human capital development is the suitably skilled and transformed formed workforce. And we want to share best practices with other organizations. We want organizations, biodiversity organizations, whether they be public or private or NGOs, that they are well managed, good people, and they retain good professions in our sector. and as we call it, institutional strengthening, and we've been involved with environment affairs in this as well. And these are, this is the 2% of non-achievement out of the 98% of achievement of targets in 2015-16, Chair. And it is just, I think, the way that we set out the target and what was achievable, and our approach here after much discussion is that we need to do it slightly different, and we will rather support municipal and provincial partners going forward, so there is no such target in the 2016-17 APP. Next, please. Again, under platforms for coordination and advocacy around human capital development, we achieved our targets. We've also changed this target a little bit going forward in the APP 2016-17. But also again, human capital, the issue around number of black biodiversity professionals developed through our initiatives. We have a number of initiatives, both internal and external, in Sandy, and it's a new target, so it's not applicable for 15-16, and the achievements, the annual target was difficult to break down into quarters as it was a new target, but we are exceeding what we think is the target here, yeah. And obviously the corrective measures is more around how do we present what we do here and how do we measure this year. And we'll have to do this corrective, I think, at the end of the financial year. Next week. This is another area, Chair, it's all part of our human capital development. It's very unrewarding look when you do it because you think that in career guidance of young people at high schools will not really, you know, it's one of those things you do quietly behind. But in fact, we find that working with schools around biodiversity career, engaging with them, giving them resources to do it has actually benefited us. So we achieved the target this year in 2015-16. We're a bit behind the target this year. And we've got collective measures in place. We do feel that we will achieve our annual target, if not our second quarter target, by next quarter. Thank you. Next, please. Yeah, again, it's also part of our human capital development. It's about the beneficiaries of our botanical gardens, and particularly school-based problems. We have enormous school-based problems. Our baseline has been about 44,000 young kids coming through our gardens, through our education center, and having structured educational tours. And many poorly resourced schools use our gardens as their field trip to do their environment affairs work. And 2015-16 grew more ambitious and made it to 48,000, and we did achieve that target. Our quarter target is 12,000 beneficiaries, and we've achieved that target in this first quarter. Next, please. We, part of the human capital development and where we put this target here is the number of platforms that we've developed for to engage civil society so that they can contribute not only to understanding biodiversity but also to our monitoring and conservation efforts. And our baseline work, interesting to read, we've done quite a lot previously, and we really now are in the process of strengthening those platforms. CRU is a civil society structure of mainly retired folks who have in this last year actually uncovered species that we thought were extinct. All over the country, and they're all over the country. iSpot would also encourage you to see, to look at its our device to make you be a scientist, be a nerd in that space. You can take a photograph of the species, you can upload it, you can have a whole team, a whole crowd of people who know about the species will tell you the taxonomy, the classification. We also use the data then to show where species occurrence is. And SAVEUP is the bird access program We quite famously bring phonetic birders to help us with our understanding of our bird population. We achieved all our targets last year, and we are a bit behind, mainly because of supply chain management for the contract. So the corrective measures is obviously to that. I don't know if Kamal wants to say something more about that. Next, please. So consolidated, in 2015-16, we achieved 98% of our targets. Reasons to really like us, Jay. And as I indicated, one target behind, we didn't achieve, we did not achieve any of the targets. So the target that we were, that is yellow there, was partially achieved. And we modified one target during midterm with the minister. 16-17, of the 58 targets planned, we are on schedule with 27. We are ahead with 4. Not that being ahead makes any difference to the Auditor General, actually, but we'd like to put it there. And then we are behind schedule in 7. I've explained some of them, and I asked Ms. Ndiso to explain some of those ones that are in her area. And so we're not in the process of having no targets achieved. Next, please. No, and this is a demographic that we've been asked questions about before, and my head of HR, Mr. Nichiongo, has produced just to give you a sense of the demographic spread of us, of staff. At the minute, we're standing at 685 staff members. The spread from level 2 in the public service to level 16, myself, level 16, not level 16, and we are based in 10 places. We don't have a garden in Durban. What was the other one I didn't mention? We don't have a garden in Durban, but we do have a herbarium in Durban and staff there. So that gives you a sense of the spread. The geographic spread, demographic spread, doesn't give you the geographic spread, it gives you demographic spread. But I'm just giving you a context in terms of geography. Next, please. And this is our employee, but sorry, just could you go to the slide before? This was a quarter 15-16 year end demographic spread, and then given the new financial year and some of the outstanding things. If you go to the next slide, that's the quarter one demographic spread. So for example, African males have increased by 3 in this last quarter. Is it 4? Sorry. Yeah. That's all. Next, please. Okay.
Can we take a body break?
Okay.
It's been a marathon. So the body needs to rest a bit and come back. So I don't know whether there's tea. If there's no tea, we can just do a leg stretch and come back after 5 minutes.
Five minutes.
Yeah.
I don't know. Thank you.
In quarter one, we've got a few that we are not on board from. That's why there's yellows in the quarter one, 2016, 2017. Yeah. Mainly because it changed the time for the 2016, 2017, yeah. So not applicable, it just changed, yeah. But every year we have to do a slight change of the target, yeah. So that's why that table is kind of complicated to work on, because they're not quite, it's not saying apples with apples in a way. Yeah. If you go to the previous table, it's a continuation of the previous table. Okay. A target has not been set. You're right, I think we should have changed the color for that, yeah. Yeah, then it can be confusing, you're right, yeah. 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 It should be or nothing. Or nothing, nothing, more like it, yeah. It was quite complicated to do this, actually, and originally I was asking my colleagues, why are we not just doing one around, giving you a full view about 15, 16, and then a full view about 16, 17. But this is a template that
they wanted all of us to follow.
Yeah, same template, yeah. Page.
Hello, but as you say, next quarter, you only see 15, 16 is next.
Can you get back to work? Madame Narato's call. Can you take us through the financial? We were planning to finish at 1, and it's already 1 now, and there's not been any provision made for food for lunch for the members, so if we can push that at least by 1:30, we're done. Yeah. So yeah, we can stretch it for another 30 minutes.
Thank you,
sir. I'm not saying you should take another 30 minutes. We still have time for questions and so forth, yeah.
I'll be mindful of the time, sir. Afternoon to you, honorable committee members. My name is Borato Shitola, and I'll be taking you through the 2015-16 winter financials and also quarter one of 2016-17. We've already submitted our financials to National Treasury, and the AG has performed the audit. So we have, the results are based on what has been audited by the AG, and we've received our final audit opinion, which is an unqualified audit opinion. However, it has some material adjustments, which I'll talk to on the second slide. And we also have an emphasis of matter as a result of the cumulative restated prior year figures. We do not have any record of irregular and fruitless and racial expenditure as per the AG report. And the material adjustments were mainly because of two issues. One, we had an issue with the government grant. We had an adjustment which unfortunately was not communicated to the NPP. We have, however, addressed it with the department, and we believe that it has now been resolved and it will not occur. The second issue was around minor assets, which have become material over time. And it's a matter that we are now dealing with, and it should be resolved by the time that the AG comes back for the interim audit. In terms of financial performance, we are reporting a surplus of 34 million. Last year we reported 26 million. There is negative growth overall. Revenue has reduced, and also expenditure, mainly because of one project that has moved to the department, working for wetlands project. I will be going through those two line items in a little bit more detail. On the next slide, the revenue. As I've already said, we have reported 590 million, which is 16% reduction from last year. If you look at the main area where it has reduced, it's on the second line there on other grants, sponsorships and donations, which is mainly where our project income comes through. We had a reduction of 48% from the previous financial year, mainly because of one project, the Waiting for Wetlands project, which has moved back to the department. In terms of revenue, our internal generated revenue, we have grown it slightly with 5% from 84 million to 88 million for the year, with the details tabled there on below. On the next slide is a graphical representation of the spread of our revenue in 1560, which is slightly in line with how we performed also in 1415. The biggest revenue from our own efforts is mainly from admission income into the National Botanical Gardens, which is 63%, followed by rental income of 17%, which is mainly the restaurants that are being run by tenants on our National Gardens, National Botanical Gardens. The next slide takes us through revenue still, comparing it year on year, where it's basically a graphical representation of the other slide that we went through. And the blue is mainly the prior year, with the orange the current year. And you'll notice that the greatest difference is on the other grants and donations and sponsorships. The next slide, now we look at expenditure. Overall expenditure has also reduced by 18% from 593 million to 485. Personnel has reduced by 2%, mainly because of the reduction at on projects from 83 million to 55 million. Then in terms of operating expenditure, it's also reduced 37%. Mainly also on projects. I think it's quite clear that our expenditure in terms of projects moves in line with the revenue as well. Then we have other items which are quite important in terms of our reporting standards to tabulate on the face of the financials. And one of the items that has grown quite significantly is our repair and maintenance at 32%, purely because of the infrastructure growth on the campuses, along with the depreciation on property, plant and equipment. On the next slide, it also a spread of where, of how we are spending our resources. The biggest portion goes to personnel expenditure with 56%, followed by OPEX 38 and the other smaller elements. Expenditure year-on-year comparison, the biggest difference is on OPEX, where you see prior year there being blue with 293 million versus 184 in the current year. Overall, when analyzing where our surplus comes from, it's mainly because of the acquisition of property, plant and equipment. In terms of accounting standards, we recognize the revenue on the income statement. However, when we purchase the assets, they are recorded on the balance sheet, which is further reduced by 51 million that we would have charged for depreciation and amortization of fixed assets, which is mainly the recognition of the use of the assets over their useful life. In terms of financial position, the organization at the end of the year was still solvent and still liquid, meaning that our assets exceeded liabilities and we were still capable of meeting all the obligations the organization has. We have assets of 511 million against liabilities of 214 million. On the next slide is a graphical representation of our financial position, with most of the assets being in non-current assets, and that's where our property, plant and equipment would also be, followed by current assets and the other items as well, being slightly lower. Comparison of financial position year on year, we can see that our non-current assets have grown year on year, current assets are reduced. I think that explanation will come later when we get the cash flow statement. Non-current liabilities remain roughly the same, and current liabilities have also reduced. Then I will move on to the ratios. In terms of the Asian part, we have been given a green, a favorable status based on all our indicators in totality, and this was to present to the committee as to how we have fared overall. Next slide on the cash flow statement. We have negative operating cash flow of 9 million overall. Last year we had positive cash flow from operating activities. Unfortunately, this year we have expended more than what we had received, which has then led to a reduction in our current assets, cash balances. In terms of investing activities, we had an outflow of 51 million, bringing the total net decrease in cash and cash equivalent of 60 million. On the next slide, the cash and cash equivalent at reduction of 60 million was mainly because of project expenditure or commitments that were there with the donors and long-term contractual obligations. So the cash was being spent out of the resources that were already available in the organization. On 2016-17 quarter one performance, we are also posting a negative or a net deficit for the quarter. In terms of the income, we are 18% below budget, mainly because of the government grant. We are still waiting for the infrastructure grant, which will be coming through from the department. In terms of our own revenue, our own internally generated revenue, we are slightly below our budget. And the main contributor is our rental income. You will see that in terms of admission fees, we have performed quite well. We are 5% above what we have budgeted for. However, probably because of the low visitor numbers at the restaurants, hence our rental income would be slightly lower. We receive rental income in addition to a percentage on the profit that they make from the patrons that visit the restaurant. So we do have a direct feel of the visitor numbers at the restaurant. In terms of spending, we are within budget on personnel and operating expenditure, with CAPEX expenditure a little bit over-expanded as a result of commitments from last year. Then overall, the position as at the end of quarter one, we are still solvent and liquid, and we believe we will meet our financial targets for the year. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. She requested some of you to make additions. Can you do that quickly?
Okay. In relation to targets that have not been achieved in the first quarter, I think the most important one to explain is where we have planned to do a SPIDAS assessment. And are now focusing on lionfish. We do a lionfish assessment instead of the spider assessment. And our main reason for rather focusing on lionfish is really because of Operation Bakissa, and the focus more on lionfish. It seems to be more of a priority. However, we are continuing with the spider assessment, but our target will be modified to be a lionfish assessment as opposed to a spider assessment. which is seen from a political context to be much more important and economic, that we get that assessment out. Chair, on the other topics that we behind on, we anticipate that we're going to catch up on them. I don't know if you would like me to go through and just elaborate a bit, or if maybe there's some questions around those others, but otherwise I can't quickly take you through them.
Well, I think we're done. We're ready to ask questions. The other colleague that says, covered.
Okay, I think we're subsequently the CEO actually covered the point.
Okay.
During the presentation.
All right, thank you for the presentation. It was quite a long presentation. Colleagues, do you have questions? I think the point that we must just make is that probably in future we'll have to separate the reports. The other four must be separate one to the bottom one, because it can be a bit confusing. So that's just a point to make, but I for one don't have any question to ask. I think straightforward. We congratulate you on meeting the target of 98% for the quarter four. And normally the first quarter is just work in progress. Sometimes it's not a good measurement to determine whether you will be able to meet the target for the whole year, but it does show you that you need to not to lose sight of the goal. But I think you did well, including the financial performance is good. So colleagues don't have questions. So just quick one.
The CEO has just extended an invitation to you folks once more, said please visit the gardens.
We once given this visiting card, now they have expired to name.
Chairman, if I may respond to just one.
Okay.
We'll
give you the last
no, Chair, I just thought perhaps you can share with us if there's any sector that accounts for less visitor numbers this quarter, which was supposed to be accommodative of the ISAs, and so what could have been the issue? No.
Thank you, sir. Your assets, tell them that they include your biological assets as well. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay. Quick one from your side. Maybe what you can do, just to start from the slides, and then the CEO and the deputy chair of the board, and then we are done.
Thanks, Chair. Just on the members' visitor cards, we are busy reviewing that. I've been working with the secretariat to get a list of new members' names. And so the cards, once they are ready, we will make sure that you get them.
By the way?
I cannot commit because we're working with our other organization for top. That's why we choose the card. But the process has already started. So we will expedite the process.
Yeah. Okay. When you say we are working on it, you can work for it on it for the whole year. Okay. By end of October, we'll be available.
Yes,
sir.
to respond on the visitor number. If you look at the report, the visitor numbers in terms of entrance fees has gone up. However, on the rental, which is related to our restaurant visit, it has decreased. So it shows that in terms of footage on the gardens, there is more people coming, but there are less people going to the restaurant. So it could be an economic issue. People may be visiting with their own picnic basket instead of eating at the restaurant. The biological assets, we are guided by accounting standards, and interestingly, on the biological assets, an item is only considered a biological asset when it has been developed for sale and it's on market for sale. And a lot of our material is not available for sale. So we have a very small portion of our assets as biological assets. However, I think in the pipeline there's a new accounting standard that is being developed that looks at natural resources that an organization like us would manage. So we will most likely see the impact of it as soon as it's adopted.
Okay, thank you.
So just to reiterate, Chair, that I really wish we could tell you more about our adaptation project. It's very interesting. The other thing maybe just to tell you coming along the way where biological assets might actually be an issue is that we are, have been asked by our Minister and Minister of Science and Technology to take over a national zoo, which is, we only have one national zoo in Victoria, and it's the zoo is a enclosed animals of all kinds for display, but also does research. They are the leading research institution, for example, on genetics of biodiversity. So it's quite a good thing that in theory that they're coming to us, but it will mean that we are going to have a whole other area of work which is about managing animals in enclosures. And there I think we will have a biological assets thing that we are going to have to manage, because and when the new accounting standard comes in, we're going to have to grapple with them about how do we do that. So it's a very new challenge for us, and be interesting for us to come and report to you about our problem. It's managed by DST, Science and Technology, through NRF, ironically, Natural Research Foundation. And they have a number of institutions, including things like Itemba Labs, and it's one of those very many little institutions under NRF, and they have been for the last 2 years indicating to us that it is a biodiversity role,
yes,
and therefore
it is. Yeah. Have been in the first place.
So that's going to be 1st of April. And then another thing coming along the way which you might also want to know is this Global Climate Fund that we are applying to be the NIE, which should be getting by October this year, and I think it will have enormous amount of challenges for us to make that, to use it in a way that will really contribute to some of the things that Judy Beaumont was talking about in the adaptation space. So I would really like to have an adaptation presentation, particularly to this committee.
All right. Well, we'll look at the invites. Probably we'll work a program such a way that we make a slot for you to come and make a presentation on an adaptation project that you are busy with. So we'll look at it. I see the personnel cost is about 56%. Of the total operating budget. Maybe when we meet, because we are still going to come in October, when we look at the final the annual reports, then we'll then get a sense of their staff complements, who their responsibilities and so forth. Because as an institute, I'm sure you have got a scientist, a lot of scientists. Yeah, so we'll get a sense. I don't want you to respond to it now. I think we'll deal with it in October. So you've got the last word.
No, I do thank you, Chair, honorable members. Thanks for
indulging us to share with you what Sunday is all about. It's an exciting organization. And during the break, I said the member here, maybe exercise, you need to see the type of animal that we're dealing with at Sunday. It's actually a hybrid organization. Because one part of Sunday is a hardcore scientist organization. That is why you saw us measuring ourselves in terms of publication, very much like an academic institution. Then you also have a part of it which is more like a policy advisory center of knowledge, where we advise in terms of our mandate via, so that policies are actually from a scientific base, which is another link of the organization that no members must appreciate, and the role that we play in key policy decisions for this country. The third part of it is what you were talking about, which is more like a bank, you know, if you think about it. We're really the custodians of the biodiversity of this country. You know, what do we have? What is important? What is endangered? What needs to be protected? And that's a key strategic role that Sunday plays. And the fourth part of it, which is also a unique animal, is that we are actually a facilities organization. We run facilities, you know, gardens, restaurants, entertainment facilities, and it's got its own different type of measures. And it's also a growing organization. I mean, maybe when Tanya comes back, we can review them. Just to show how the organization is growing, you're actually dealing with a growing institution. If you look at the new gardens that have been mentioned, the Toyando Garden, the Koleha Garden, the zoo, it's actually significant, you know, infrastructure development. But it is an exciting organization, and we're very proud of the performance of the organization. So, but we'd like to invite you to come and appreciate what we are all about.
Okay. All right, thank you very much. The committee has been invited to go and find time to go out on an oversized visit or whatever visit that will be. But we'll definitely take you up on the invitation. Thank you very much, the Deputy Chair, the CEO, Tanya Abrams, and your staff members, and the officials from the department. They are always welcome, and the members, the meeting is adjourned. We'll probably see each other next month. We're coming back on the 10th. So we might, now we're coming back to Parliament on the 10th, but next week we will be attending the people and pastor just waiting for the approval. We'll follow up to see the approval has been obtained. And the following week is going to be Haiti's. Actually, it's next week,
yeah?
Yeah, so the people and pastor is on Monday. Tuesday, Wednesday.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, by the 23rd, we have been requested to attend a meeting there. So we'll be there from Tuesday next week. So we'll hopefully bump into each other attending some of the sessions there. Yeah. So thank you very much. I think for members, we just have one business. So yeah, you can leave. There's just one business to attend to, the minute. So we've read the minutes. Anything on page one?
No.
Oh yeah. Okay. All right. Anything on page one? Nothing. Page two.
No.
Just record of attendance from departments. Phase 3, what a blessing from World Service. The fourth page, blessing from Shimangaliso. Last page, done. Well, on the last page, I must just say to the members, I've already dispatched the letter to the portfolio committee, and we're waiting for the response. We've given them until the 30th of September to give us a response. Just for information. So can we approve the minutes? What is the issue there? Third page.
Go ahead and share. I think the headline or the subject, the briefing by South African Weather Service, is fourth quarter, the quarter performance. But the minutes is up to Dr. Mkhethe, I think it's from Standard.
Oh, yes. Briefing by St. Patrick. No, you are right, please. You are right. We need that kind of vigilance. We get too many information sometimes. We are not meticulous in going through, but with that correction, I think Honorable Makwele, why Makwele Maluleka? I always okay. Honorable Makwele, Honorable Nyanga, second day. Yeah. Okay. We will communicate with you about the. We are just waiting for the approvals. But we have sent the submissions for what? From Tuesday. So Tuesday,
right?
From
the 19th.
So from 19 to 36. Okay. So from 19 to the 36. I don't know whether honorable member from EFS, did we make provision?
No.
So we can check whether we'll be available
from when?
Next week. But our admission did not include you because we're not sure whether by that time. But we can follow that one out. That's fine. Okay. So the meeting. Oh, tomorrow there's a meeting, but the minister had requested that she wanted to be there. So we're still going to discuss with the DG. But we're scheduled to meet tomorrow. From 10 o'clock. Are you not going to be available? No, the meeting is going to proceed. Unless the secretary has paid you that you must cancel the meeting. No, the minister is out. He's out of the country. She went to India today. That will confirm before four. But you can take the meeting is proceeding.
How are you?
How are you?